This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is now at the controls. And we're glad to have you with us for this second hour of Focus 580. My name's David Inge. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be looking back to an event that maybe is one of the most significant moments if you're looking for intersections of media and politics, probably one of the most significant moments in the last 50 years or so. And these were the debates that took place in 1960 between then presidential candidates Richard Nixon and John Kennedy. In fact, these were the first ever face-to-face encounters between major party presidential candidates. It is the case, I imagine, that probably a lot of people, if you remember the debates, you may well not remember what it is that the two candidates talked about. But it is certainly true that this event, these debates, changed presidential elections, propelling them into the age of television. In this part of the program, we'll be talking about these debates and also talk about the continuing importance of this kind of event, of debates in American politics. And the guest for the show is Newton Minow. He is an attorney. He is senior counsel of Sidley Austin LLP in Chicago, where he's practiced law since 1965. He is also Walter Annenberg Professor Emeritus of Communications and Law at Northwestern University. He is also a former chair of the FCC and a man I'm sure will be long remembered for something that he said in a speech in 1961. He was talking to the convention of the National Association of Broadcasters, and he made some comments that were quite critical of television. He said, when television is good, nothing is better, but when television is bad, nothing is worse. And he went on and he invited people to sit in front of the television all day long and watch. Keep your eyes glued, he said, to that set until the station signs off. Then he said, I can assure you, you will observe a vast wasteland. He is the co-author, along with Craig LeMay, who was associate professor of journalism at Northwestern University's Medill School, of co-author of a book that's titled Inside the Presidential Debates, Their Improbable Past and Promising Future, that does indeed look closely at the Kennedy-Nixon debates, or Nixon-Kennedy debates, whichever direction you want to go, how they came about and their significance. The book is out now. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. If you're interested, you can go looking for it. And of course, this morning on the program, questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Okay. Well, I'm just there was a moment there where we weren't sure whether we would be able also to have Professor LeMay. That was our original plan here, that we'd have both Professors Newton and LeMay. And we had a little difficult time getting in touch with Craig LeMay right at the beginning here. But we're going to do that. We'll get them both on the phone because we definitely wanted to have them both here on the telephone to talk with us about the book Inside the Presidential Debate. So as always, of course, questions and comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. All you have to do to join the conversation is give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So that's for local folks here. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, you can certainly use the long-distance or our toll-free line, which is 800-222-9455, and the call's on us. So that one, if you happen to be listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana and would be a long-distance call, use that line. And also, of course, people listening on the Internet, if you're in the United States, you can use that number as well. So that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, I think we have both guests. Mr. Minow, hello.
I'm here. Thank you, David.
And Craig LeMay.
Yes, I'm here too. Thank you.
Great. Well, I'm glad both of you could be with us. I think that it may be a little bit difficult to overstate just how important these debates were, the ones that took place between Nixon and Kennedy. And in fact, Professor Minow, you write here in the book that President Kennedy, who was the guy who was responsible for your being the FCC chair, he apparently told you, it says more than once, he told you that he believed that had it not been for these debates, he would not have been elected president.
I think he was right about that. Before the debates, he was running behind Vice President Nixon. The country really didn't know Jack Kennedy at that point, and I think the debates did establish him as trustworthy and intelligent and led to his election.
This, it's also, I guess now, because these kinds of events are such a fixture of campaigns, and not just campaigns on the presidential level. All sorts of candidates have debates. They're not always nationally televised, but they're the kind of event that a lot of candidates are willing to do. It's kind of hard to think of a time when this was a revolutionary idea.
Well,
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah. What happened was the law stood in the way. Congress, at the very beginning of broadcasting, passed something called the Equal Time Law, which requires a broadcaster to provide equal time to all candidates. And as a result, when there are many, many candidates, indeed this year there are 260 candidates for President of the United States who have signed up, registered with the Federal Elections Commission, it was impossible to have a debate. But in 1960, as an experiment, the Congress exempted the presidential race from the Equal Time Law, and that permitted the debates to be established.
I think, Professor LeMay, you wanted to add something on to that?
I just wanted to say that I think that the debates are not so... they are an unusual thing. I'm not sure we should take them for granted. In this particular presidential race, we've seen a lot of debates, and they've been very attractive to the candidates because, of course, this year is the first time, and I think Newell will correct me, since 1952, since there hasn't been an incumbent or a sitting vice president running. So all of these people have needed the national attention, and the time has been, from their perspective, at no cost. And at this point, we know more, I think Americans know more about the three likelies for president than they often would late in a presidential season.
And I think, I'm sure both of you would agree that for whatever criticisms people might have of these events and how they're structured and what happens, that it is valuable for potential voters to see candidates in this setting. That is, they get the opportunity to learn something about them that they otherwise could not. And for that reason, as I'm sure both of you would say, it's a good thing that we do these.
I think there's no question about it. Otherwise, we'd be limited to commercials, which often are fleeting and distort the fact. So I think the debates are a great contribution to the democratic process.
Well, especially so, I think, in presidential elections, where you'll recall in 2004, Illinois didn't see much of the candidates because it was a foregone conclusion that it would vote Democratic. And so in places where the candidates don't go and you get only the commercials, those debates are really the only opportunity voters in the state have to see these people speaking extemporaneously. And we get our, as lawyers call it, demeanor evidence. And see how they behave in certain kinds of situations.
Professor Minow, you mentioned that one of the things that had to happen for the debates to happen was that Congress had to grant a temporary waiver of the Equal Time Law that was part of the rules of the FCC. That is, the law said you give time to one candidate, you're going to have to give time to anybody else who comes and asks. And something that later, I think, was permanently changed.
Well, what happened was in 1964, the incumbent president, Lyndon Johnson, did not want a debate, so he passed the word to Congress to leave the Equal Time Law in effect. In 1968, the same thing happened. In 1972, the same thing happened. So for three consecutive presidential elections, there were no debates. Until 1976, when the FCC, without congressional action, reinterpreted the Equal Time Law to say that a debate was exempt from the Equal Time requirement because it was a news event. And that's how we've had the debates ever since.
This touches on what I'm sure for a lot of people is maybe a sore spot when it comes to these debates, and that is the question of who is invited to participate.
This is a dilemma which confronts every country, and Craig in particular, who's an expert on debates all around the world. I'd ask Craig if you'd tell us a little bit about what happens in other countries in dealing with the question of who's included.
Certainly. It's an issue everywhere, and particularly in parliamentary systems where you have multiple parties putting candidates forward. But I guess most people would be surprised to learn that the American presidential debates are among the most productive and educational in the world. Many, including in Western European democracies, still devolve into shouting matches with accusations flying. Some countries don't have debates at all. The UK has no debates. Which surprises a lot of people, but where they do occur frequently, the countries that hold them will come to the United States and try to model, to the extent they can, their debates after ours.
Perhaps I should reintroduce just very quickly our guests, Newton Minow and Craig LeMay. Newton Minow is Walter Annenberg Professor Emeritus of Communications and Law at Northwestern University. He's a senior counsel of Sidley Austin LLP, where he's practiced law since 1965. Also, he's former chair of the Federal Communications Commission. Craig LeMay is Associate Professor of Journalism at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. And they are the co-authors of the book Inside the Presidential Debates, Their Improbable Past and Promising Future. It's published by the University of Chicago Press and in part looks at the first presidential debates, the ones between took place in 1960 between Richard Nixon and John Kennedy. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Given the fact that back in 1960 there were other candidates, how did those other candidates react to the fact that they were not going to be included in this event?
Well, one of them went to court to challenge what Congress had done, and the court agreed with Congress that this was constitutional, and as a result, every time we have a debate, somebody challenges it in court, but the courts have held that as long as there is a clear criterion established of who's included, and the Presidential Debate Commission now uses the criterion of 15% support on an average of the five leading public opinion polls, and that's been upheld in the courts.
Although in 1960 those criteria were not in place, and the debate occurred, of course, just between the two major party candidates. Had there been debates in 1968, for example, there would have been a fair question as to whether George Wallace should have been included. And the criterion that are used today, that 15% criterion, was developed originally by the League of Women Voters in, I believe, I'm going to say 1980, with respect to John Anderson. And then evolved over time and has been tested many times in the courts. And we write in the book that while it's not a perfect standard, it is at least an objective one, not a subjective one. And it has worked to include at least one candidate, and that would have been Ross Perot. While he wasn't admitted strictly on that basis, but he was included in 1992 and then not in 96 because his support was so low. And that surprised many people. I think one of the reasons there's so much attention to the 15% rule is because it didn't make sense to many people that Mr. Perot could compete in 92 but not 96. And then, of course, more recently, Ralph Nader has complained loudly and publicly that he should have been included, despite the fact that his public support fell way below 15%.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things here is that if you look back at how it is these debates came about, the proposal, the idea, did not come from either the Nixon or the Kennedy campaigns. This idea was actually proposed by Adlai Stevenson, the one who was at one time governor of the state of Illinois, which was, Professor Minow, this was a colleague of yours.
Well, I was an assistant to Adlai when he was governor of Illinois, was with him in his two campaigns for president in 1952 and 1956. And later I became his law partner and was his law partner until he went into the government as ambassador to the UN, and I went into the government. But Stevenson, having experienced twice the campaigns for president, proposed in 1960 in a magazine article that we would have much better campaigns if the candidates appeared on television and discussed the issues, and that led to the congressional action.
And how initially did the two campaigns, the Nixon and Kennedy campaigns, react to this possibility? What were they? Did they seem that they were interested right from the beginning? They thought, well, this is a great thing. Let's do this. Was there hesitancy on the part of either of the two men or their campaigns when the idea was proposed?
On the Kennedy side, there was no question. He wanted a debate because he knew he was behind, and he felt it was an opportunity to catch up. On the Nixon side, even Nixon's press secretary, Herb Klein, was astonished at a press conference when Nixon was asked if he would debate, and he said yes, because it's usually the fellow who's ahead who doesn't want a debate.
Right, and apparently historian Michael Beschloss tells the story that Nixon saw Kennedy give his acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention and felt that it was not a very strong speech and that he could take him. And so, yes, he did surprise everyone when he agreed to a debate.
Yeah. So he obviously now from what people remember about this, if they actually saw them, if they were old enough to actually see them, or if they've read about them over the years, they know that John Kennedy came off very well. He was known to be a very attractive and charismatic man, and that Richard Nixon did not. Again, the sort of the famous thing that people remember about this is that people who listened to these debates on the radio said they thought that Nixon had performed better. But if you watched them on television and you saw the two men, you thought that Mr. Kennedy performed better because Mr. Nixon was not particularly telegenic. He looked uncomfortable, he just simply did not come across well on television, and John Kennedy did. So obviously that was the kind of thing, maybe that was the kind of thing that no one really thought about or quite understood, just how important the presentation of the candidates, how they appeared, how they would come off, what that would mean for people's evaluation of them and their performance.
In the case of Vice President Nixon and the first debate, I want to talk about the first one. He arrived at the CBS studio in Chicago not feeling well. He then knocked his knee against the door of the car as he got out. He was wearing a light colored suit, and he walked in and he was asked if he wanted to have makeup, and it was kind of a macho thing. He thought Kennedy was not having makeup, and he said no, and he didn't realize that Kennedy had a slight makeup on before he arrived at the studio. In any event, although his answers were intelligent and forceful, I think his appearance did affect him. Now, I had a funny experience in the very same studio 6 years later. Nixon was in Chicago campaigning for the Republican congressional candidates and was invited by CBS to an interview, and I was invited to appear with him in the very same studio where he had debated with Kennedy. Mm-hmm. So naturally, before the camera went on, I said to him, Mr. Vice President, do you remember this studio? And he grabbed my arm and looked at me, and he said, how could I ever forget? So he knew what had happened.
So he knew, as much as John Kennedy, we talked earlier about, as much as John Kennedy said to you, he felt that that the debates were responsible for him being elected president. Obviously, Mr. Nixon realized that they certainly hadn't done him any good.
There's no question about that.
Which I suppose invites questions about whether in these kind of events, whether style becomes elevated over substance.
That's always a criticism. I think to some extent it's unfair. Style does matter. And substance is sometimes forgotten, but you know, in the Kennedy, in the first debate between Kennedy and Nixon, the majority of the discussion was about two small islands in the Pacific that no one remembers anymore. The subject of French Indochina, as it was called, came up and was dismissed almost immediately as having no consequence for the country. And certainly Kennedy was tan, handsome, composed, and Nixon was, as New says, ill. But going forward, people often remember substantive moments. Everyone remembers Gerald Ford's remark about Poland not being under Soviet influence. They remember President Carter's talking about consulting with his daughter about nuclear weapons and so forth. Some of these might be characterized as gaffes, but they're also substantive. It's certainly the only place where you, in the campaign, where most of us get to hear the candidates talk about substances like. And if they're sometimes vague or if they give canned answers to questions, you know, that happens everywhere in the world. It's not unique to us, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I think, Professor Minow, were you going to?
Well, I was just going to say there are some moments that people will always remember. President Reagan saying to President Carter, "There you go again." Lloyd Benson saying to Dan Quayle, "You're no Jack Kennedy." So those moments stand out, but I still believe, as Craig does, that because there are multiple debates, there are three presidential, one vice presidential debate, the voters have a chance to make a judgment, not just on one-liners, but they see how the candidate thinks, whether they trust the candidate, and I believe that the debates are very, very informative to most American voters.
I think they also are substantive. The fact that the press will often cover them as political theater doesn't change the fact that they are substantive. I think, in fact, we recommend in the book that when people watch the debates, that the first thing they do when the debates are over is turn the television off and discuss among themselves, their family, their friends, the substance of the thing, before they go back and see what the pundits have to say.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's interesting here that you offer in the book is an appendix that includes the text of a memorandum of understanding for debates between the Bush and Kerry campaigns for 2004, and spells out in some detail things like the rules, the moderators, and the rules, and this runs to how it will be staged and so forth. And this runs to, at least in the book, I believe about 12 pages. It's fairly long and detailed. And one of the things that I wonder about going back to the Kennedy-Nixon debates was how much time the two candidates or the two campaigns spent or invested in talking about these sorts of issues, the format, how it was to be carried out, how it was to happen. Did they invest that much time and thought in the structure of the events?
There was a lot of back and forth about structure and format, and in the 60 debates were sponsored by the television networks at that time. And because the people so you had a three-way negotiation between the networks and the two candidates. And in later years, those memoranda got more and more complicated to the point where in 2004, which we also print in the book, the agreement between the Kerry campaign and the Bush campaign is even a more comprehensive memorandum. And our debate commission at that point said, "We're just not going to sign it. We're going to do it our way." And so the commission has become more and more adamant about bringing the debates to the voters, where the voters, rather than the candidates, are in charge.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that these events have become so firmly established now that I would find it difficult to imagine that a candidate would refuse to participate.
We've now had nine presidential debates. Hmm. We've had eight consecutive presidential debates. Young people are not even aware that there were no debates in 64, 68, 72. So I think at this point a candidate has to debate.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The debates are a product of historical good fortune, the farsightedness of a handful of individuals, including especially Newt, But he's right. They've been a consistent feature of presidential campaigns for long enough now that we believe they are unavoidable, and that any candidate who refused to debate would debase himself in front of his or her supporters. In fact, we talk in the book, you'll recall that in 1992, George Bush Sr. was hesitant about debating President Clinton. And everywhere he went, in public appearances, he was hectored by people dressed up in chicken suits. And our belief is that, certainly today with the Internet, that if any candidate tried to avoid debating, he or she would be pecked to pieces by virtual chickens, millions of them.
Let me just very quickly, we have a caller, very quickly again introduce the guests, Craig LeMay and Newton Minow. Craig LeMay is Associate Professor of Journalism at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. Newton Minow is Walter Annenberg Professor Emeritus of Communications and Law at Northwestern. He's Senior Counsel of Sidley Austin LLP, where he has practiced law since 1965. He is also a former chair of the Federal Communications Commission. He was appointed by President Kennedy in 1961 to that post. And they are the co-authors of the book Inside the Presidential Debates, Their Improbable Past and Promising Future, which takes a look at the history of these debates going back to the very first that took place in 1960 between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon. It's published by the University of Chicago Press. And certainly from people who are listening, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes, this is fascinating. I want to say, let me give you the disclaimer. Every day I wake up, I'm relieved that there is one less day in the George W. Bush administration. So I'm going to be upfront with you. But I find that how the debate worked out in 2000 between Vice President Gore and then Governor Bush, I thought that, and especially if you look at the interaction of the media and what our media is today, is gotcha and spin. I thought that we chose the wrong man for the wrong reasons, or at least the Supreme Court eventually did, because Vice President Gore, in my opinion, was very up on the substantive policy issues. I thought that Governor Bush was a lightweight then. And I think that Gore was viewed because he was apparently impatient with some of the responses of Bush, which were, in some instances were fuzzy math. He took a hit from the media and I think from the public as not being very likable, whereby George W. Bush, whom I thought had the depth of knowledge of a retarded mosquito, got bonus points from those debates for, quote, being very likable. And in that sense, I find the debates will be a little bit disturbing in terms of their effect on the political and electoral process. Would you care to respond?
I would. I would agree with you about that first debate. You'll recall that first debate too was with the one in Miami where the Mr. Bush was constantly contorting his face, and so there was funny to watch. This is why we say people should turn off the television set and discuss it among themselves. I don't recall, I watched that debate, and I don't recall being particularly bothered by anything Vice President Gore did. Now, my political biases are the same as yours, or political preferences are, so maybe it's just me. But I thought certainly that the Vice President won on points, substance points. But that's why we have debates, so other people can watch and come to their own conclusions, even if they're not mine.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to share that with you. And again, I think a party to this that I think if the founding fathers could see what has happened to the media and how they should be a check on such activities by their reporting, I think they also play a role in diminishing what I would consider the legitimate purposes of these presidential debates. But thank you.
All right. Thank you. I don't know, Professor Minow, you want to weigh in on that at all?
Many people think, for example, in the last election, many people think that Kerry did better in the debates than President Bush, but President Bush won the election. The studies indicate that the debates usually do not decide an election. They really confirm what most voters thought before the debate. Their view is confirmed. But once in a while, it does change people's minds, and I believe the one place where it clearly did was in 1960.
All right. Well, other questions are definitely welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm curious about what either of you would think about the attempts to develop a kind of a format that gets some citizen participation, either the kind of thing that we call the town hall forum kind of thing, where there's an audience there, and the audience gets to ask questions, or some of the things that have happened now in this over this last primary season, where new technology essentially has been employed to give citizens a chance to ask the question.
We have a chapter in the book on that, and I'd ask Craig to enlarge on it a little bit.
Sure. Well, we certainly encourage greater public participation when asked. That's the thing the public wants most. It says that they want fewer, we'll call them canned responses from the candidates, and they want the candidates to address each other directly rather than just speak to the moderator. And they want to have input on the questions. So the town hall format is a good one, and certainly we've seen some fascinating experiments in this primary season with online debates. Many of them, watched in overwhelming numbers by young people, first-time voters. YouTube debates, some of these have been sponsored with traditional news organizations like CNN, but all kinds of interesting formats where, for example, people have asked questions by sending in videos of themselves asking the questions. Some of these have been a little silly, I guess I'll say, but the experiments have been, I think, admirable, and we expect them to increase. In fact, one of the things you can certainly see from this primary season is that there are lots of potential sponsors for debates out there. The requirements to meet the legal requirements set out by the Fair Elections Commission are not such that only the Commission on Presidential Debates could host debates. So I think the commission itself will have to look at it this primary season and look at all the inventive things that have been done and realize that it, too, needs to sort of figure out a way to make much better use of these technologies and to bring people, more people, into the tent.
Something that I'm very struck by, it has to do with the way that the two candidates relate to one another during the course of the debate. And I'm struck by the fact that, for example, I'm looking at the memorandum of understanding that had been entered into between the Bush and Kerry campaigns in 2004. Now, I think Professor Minow said that the commission decided they were going to make their own rules. But one of the things that is spelled out here very clearly is that while the candidates can ask rhetorical questions, it says here the candidates may not ask each other direct questions. I think some people would like to see something like that, but do the candidates not want to do that?
The candidates are advised by their consultants not to look mean or nasty or like a bad person. So they want either the press or somebody else to ask the tough questions. Mm-hmm. This year, the commission has already announced that we planned to have the candidates at some point question each other.
Hmm. And do you have any sort of a feeling about whether or not the candidates will want to do that, or whether they would still take this same position? No doubt they would get the same kind of advice, that you don't want to look like you're being too aggressive. Do you think candidates would actually want to do that?
I think they may not want to do it, but I think we're going to push them to do it.
Oh, uh-huh.
I think it's an evolutionary process, too. You see the changes in debate style and format that we've seen in the primary debates will encourage changes in the kinds of rules that the commission has always worked with. And I think because the commission, we argue in the book that the commission has a lot of clout that it does not use. And we believe that clout extends to this kind of thing, asking if not compelling the candidates to talk directly to one another. But I also think in time you'll have a candidate, perhaps this year, who really doesn't fit the old mold and doesn't follow the usual advice. And, once these changes come into the system, and then they become fixtures in the system. So we're certainly hopeful, and we think, again, the public wants this. It's at the top of its list of things it's like to see in the debate.
I've been very privileged to have been involved with every single debate that we, starting in 1960. And as time has gone on, I think we've succeeded, the country has succeeded, in establishing a very important American tradition people expect debates. The candidates have learned that they should debate. We pick the dates and places long in advance because it's very hard. We don't want the candidates saying, well, I can't make it that date. Many of them used to try to get out of debates by saying, I can't fit it into my schedule. We've now established that this is part of a campaign, and everybody anticipates it will happen. If it didn't happen, I think the candidate who obstructed it would be in big trouble.
All right, let's talk with someone else here in Mahomet, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This isn't exactly a debate question, but I think it really influenced the direction that the last election went. What can we do to keep private entities from swift voting somebody on television? Like they tore Kerry up. I really think that he probably would have won decisively if it were not for those swift vote ads. How can we legally stop that from happening? Thank you.
All right. Both of you can comment on the caller's question. I guess my feeling is you can't.
Yeah.
Can you?
Well, one of the things that's certainly different about the United States, I mentioned that the UK doesn't have debates. Neither does it have political advertising. We do. We rely on candidates here. You know, when you look at the money that public officials have to raise, it goes overwhelmingly to television time. And then, of course, you have these private groups that, under current law, are allowed to, you know, run these commercials. So, as far as I can tell, it's just at least for the time being, it's just a feature of our campaign landscape.
Also, many people criticized the Kerry campaign for not responding quickly to these swift boat ads. They thought they weren't important, and the swift boat ads continued for a period before they were answered. I think the candidates have learned now that if they are attacked falsely or inaccurately, they've got to speak up and answer it immediately.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guests are Newton Minow and Craig LeMay. Newton Minow is an attorney in Chicago. He's also the Walter Annenberg Professor Emeritus of Communications and Law at Northwestern University, served one time as the chair of the Federal Communications Commission. He was appointed chair in 1961 by John Kennedy. And as he just said, he's someone who has been involved in presidential debates now from the very first, the ones that took place between Kennedy and Nixon in 1960. Craig LeMay is Associate Professor of Journalism at Northwestern's Medill School, and together they are the co-authors of the book Inside the Presidential Debates, Their Improbable Past and Promising Future, published by the University of Chicago Press. Questions are certainly welcome. We have time for some others. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Given Professor Minow, given the fact that you've actually been involved with these things all the way along, if you take a look at the commission, the debate commission that exists now, are there things that you still wish that you could do, or features that you would like to build into the debates? And perhaps we've talked about some of those things along the lines of how the candidates relate to one another and how you get citizens to participate, but other things that you would like to be able to do that you yet haven't done?
The main thing is what we've mentioned before. We want to make the format more spontaneous, have the candidates question each other, open up to new technologies where I think in this particular election, 2008, there are many people who will watch the debates on their computers rather than their television sets. There'll be all kinds of online things. So I think we're learning as we go on. But the main thing is to set aside 4 90-minute periods without commercial advertising, but to have a serious discussion of the issues. And very often I've been asked, did this candidate win that debate or did that candidate win that debate? And I said, what counts is that the American people won the debate.
Also, I would want to add that the Commission on Presidential Debates, which comes in for a lot of criticism, some of it fair, but I think most of it unfair, deserves a lot of credit for putting on a very serious, sober, intelligent program every 4 years. There are a lot of things that have happened in this primary season that I do not want to see become a regular feature of debates. I remember in one debate, for example, Chris Matthews asking candidates, quote, what do you hate most about America? And another, Wolf Blitzer, asking candidates, and I believe it was a Democratic primary debate, to just raise their hands, yes or no, to a series of highly polarized, you know, binary propositions. And finally, that ended when Barack Obama said he wasn't going to do it anymore. I think when you see the kinds of entertainment values that have creeped into some of these primary debates, I certainly think my stars that the commission doesn't do that. It's been extremely fortunate to have had very good people moderating these debates, particularly in Jim Lehrer over the last several years. And I think between Mr. Lehrer and the commission, they both deserve an enormous amount of credit for the enduring success of these debates.
Well, I suppose that raises the question, how much control does the commission have over the moderator and how the moderator conducts the debate?
The commission picks the moderators. We made the mistake in early years when I was involved with the League of Women Voters and later with the commission of letting the candidates veto certain panelists or moderators. We no longer permit that.
Well, let's talk with someone else who is here listening in Urbana, where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you for the show.
Yeah.
I haven't watched a presidential debate in probably 20 years. One of the reasons I stopped is because I think the formats are sometimes meaningless and that the candidates that are given access to the debate seem to be sort of the blessed of the popular press. Kucinich's efforts to stay in debates during this last race, as an example. How open do you think the debate formats should be? What kind of capacity to get votes should a candidate have to prove? How do we get a good, healthy mix between a depth of questioning and a maximum number of people when these people take the stage? I'll listen off air. Thank you very much.
Well, again, that I'd be happy to have you address that question. We talked a little bit about that at the beginning, but this has been for a long time been a very difficult central question. Who do you invite?
Well, this is a very important question. The primary debates are not run or sponsored by the Commission on Presidential Debates. Our commission only deals with the candidates after they are nominated. There are all kinds of sponsors for the primary debates. Sometimes it's a television organization. Sometimes it's a issue organization. Sometimes there have been all kinds of sponsors, and each of them has their own rules. Many, at the beginning, most of them try to allow all the candidates, and then I think this year there were 8 Republican candidates at the beginning. I think there were 8 Democratic candidates at the beginning. So, but there's a difference between the primary and the presidential debates.
Also, in the parliamentary systems, there are often a series of runoff debates, and then you get to the final debate between the two candidates who are contesting the office. And the important thing to remember about the 15% rule, which we talked about earlier, is that it's a method, it's not the only one, but it's objective, and you can look at it and say fairly clearly that someone either meets it or not. There are lots of other subjective ways to do it that would be, I would think, unfair and illegal. I remember at one point doing our book asking a senior executive at CBS responsible for polling about the particular issues involved in polling, and her response was that she was always a little surprised that the commission didn't exercise more discretion in deciding who to permit in the debates. And that's just it. It shouldn't be at the discretion of the commission. It should be based on rules that are set out in advance and that everyone understands. Otherwise, of course, if you were to allow a third candidate, let's say Mr. Nader in 2000 or 2004, then the obvious question follows, well, what about the other 256 fellows behind him? And there's no principled response to that. If you just decide to let people in based on some notion that it's newsworthy or it seems right. So it's an impossible question to answer satisfactorily. Some party will always feel aggrieved no matter what method you choose. But I do believe that for all the criticism that the commission has received that the 15% standard, which again began with the League of Women Voters, not the commission, is a workable standard. And in fact, that Newt and I predict in the book that it's, in some time fairly soon, there will be another third-party candidate who meets that standard and participates.
Well, and we fully recognize that third parties very often contribute enormously important ideas to national discussion. The third party contribution to the democratic process is important, and it's got to be recognized.
Let's go again to another caller, someone in Chicago, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a question for your guest. Is there any limitation to the number of debates that the candidates are supposed to attend, you know, have to go through during the process, or is it limitless? Is it something that the candidates will have to decide before the debate starts? Thank you.
All right. Well, I suppose, again, here this depends upon whether you're talking about debates during the primary season or debates between candidates once the parties decide on who their candidate is going to be.
Well, it's certainly not limitless, but there is only so much time in the campaign, and voters, studies everywhere in the world show that voters have only so much attention for debates, and you can actually overwhelm them at some point and just tune them out, so you don't want to overdo it. But also, come fall when the debates begin, as a very practical matter, as televised events, they compete with many other things, including the World Series and the beginning of the NFL season. In fact, the League of Women Voters once had to do last-minute negotiations with Pete Rozelle to change the time of a football game to accommodate the debates. So, you know, and the other issue for the candidates, of course, is that when they prepare for a debate, a nationally televised debate, it freezes that campaign for a few days before and a few days after, while all attention goes to preparing for the debate and then afterwards, you know, working the debate. So the candidates only have so much interest themselves in doing that. They need to be out or want to be out conducting their campaigns in a way they think best suits them.
So it sounds as if perhaps as far as presidential candidates go and presidential debates go, that having three debates is about as much as you could expect the candidates to be willing to do.
Well, it's interesting. I negotiated the 76 debate between President Ford and Jimmy Carter. And in that case, each of them came back with exactly the same suggestions. They wanted to have three presidential and one vice presidential. They wanted them 90 minutes. They wanted a panel of questioners. I thought, you know, maybe these two guys have been speaking to each other. As it turned out, their advisors, their respective advisors, had given both of them the same advice.
Yeah. Well, just I'm now, because of what Professor LeMay just said about the fact that, yes, these events compete with other kinds of things that are on television.
Right.
I wonder whether you have sensed, either or both of you sense over time, any increasing unwillingness, let's say, on the part of the over-the-air broadcast networks to give over an hour and a half of time like this with no opportunity of selling commercials when, in fact, they could be doing something else with that 90 minutes?
We have not encountered it thus far. I would anticipate at some point we will. If you've studied what happened this primary season, most of the primary debates have been on cable.
Well, we're coming down to the point here. We have maybe about a minute or so left. I guess I'm just interested in one last time, because not only are in this book do you deal with history, but you also deal with the future. And you do indeed have a chapter here on ways that presidential debates might be improved. In addition to those things that we have talked about, what would be the major things that you would say to make them even better, what it is that we would like to do?
Craig?
Well, I would say we've covered it, really, and that is to make them have the candidates engage in a direct conversation with each other. The criticism you've often heard of, that the debates aren't, quote, real debates. Well, of course they're not. They're not academic debates, and nobody would want to watch one of those. But you would like to see the candidates, you know, look each other eye and discuss things. And of course, that would place a whole new role on the moderator. But certainly, that's something that the public says it would like to see. And we believe, we've said it many times, these are for the public, not for the candidates, and it should serve the public's interest.
Well, and I would, if we're only got a few seconds left, we've got a big country with 300 million people stretching from Key West to Alaska to Hawaii to Maine. The only way we can all share a common national experience is really through radio and television. That's why it's so important to use this great technology to help us decide on who should be our leaders. Mm.
And do you think that, you know, mentioned the fact that the primary debates essentially were cable events. I wonder, do you think that we're going to be seeing more and more of these things happening, perhaps happening as live events on the web, as internet-based events?
I think in time we're going to see more and more and more on the web.
Yeah. Not only will we see more, but I think what we'll see is we'll have people taking the video snippets of the debates and mashing them up in internet parlance and turning them into all kinds of new things that have their own lives online. Yeah. It'll be a fascinating campaign this fall, I'm sure.
Well, we want to say thanks to our guests, Craig LeMay. He is Associate Professor of Journalism at Northwestern University's Medill School. Professor LeMay, thank you very much.
We're glad.
Thank you so much.
And Newton Minow. He is the Walter Annenberg Professor Emeritus of Communications and Law at Northwestern. Professor Minow, thank you.
Well, we're both huge fans of NPR and public broadcasting. I used to be chairman of PBS, and we thank you for what you're doing.
Well, and certainly we are well aware of your strong support for public broadcasting. We certainly appreciate that very, very much. And if you want to read the book that we mentioned once again, it's titled Inside the Presidential Debates, Their Improbable Past and Promising Future. The book is published by the University of Chicago Press.